music from Luther and Toby, the Toby being one Larry Mullins. This is part two of our interview. In this episode, Larry reaches Los Angeles after getting some money wired from Black Flag's Greg Ginn. So you were wired money to go play music, presumably with Greg Ginn. You arrive in L.A., you made it. What did he have in mind for you?
Well, I didn't know. Actually, I kind of had, a fantasy that we'd start a band, you know. I kind of knew what his situation was, which was Black Flag had shut down. He had tried to make another band, this band called Gone. I think they released two records, and that had also shut down. He wasn't doing anything other than running the label, which was a mega success at that time. And but he wasn't playing with anybody. And so my timing was right on the money for that. And I thought, well, that's it. We're going to go out there, and I'm going to start a band with him. And so got there. He was really cool. I moved in with him. You know, I was sleeping in his living room. And right off the bat, he was like, well, you want to go play? And I said, sure. He's like, well, I've got a rehearsal space, and we can go play. Well, 8 hours later... You know, after really slogging it out, you know, he wanted to go jam, and I mean 8 hours. But you know, as you know, he was an extraordinary guitar player, but he didn't want to play guitar. He wanted to play bass. So we were just going to play, you know, rhythm section for like 8 hours, hardcore, you know, freak out jam for 8 hours, and I thought I was going to melt away. It was so exhausting. And we came back, and he recorded all of it, and so that night he proceeded to listen to all of it. I went to bed. I couldn't bear to hear it again. But next day, same thing. Same thing the next night. Next day, same thing. We rehearsed every day like that, 8 hours a day or something, nonstop. I think I don't know if we stopped for lunch or not. I mean, we just played like maniacs, and. You know, and I just thought, wow, this is intense. You know, it's, whoa, what's happening? And so I was trying to talk to him and what do you think about playing guitar? You know, I mean, do you know any bass players? I mean, maybe we could get a bass player and you could play guitar. Or we could, you know, take a step, you know. And he had no interest in that. And I thought, well, that's kind of disappointing. And so then I tried to sort of get an idea of what his plans were or something. He didn't really have any plans. He didn't really have any agenda or vision about what to do next. I think he just wanted to play, like play, just maniacally play, jam. And I don't know for what purpose other than just, you know, keeping in shape or I don't know. I mean, so I couldn't take it after a while, and I had to move out. I said, you know, I've got to do something, you know. So I had to move out, and he was super nice, you know. But you know, it was kind of hard for me to get on the same table as him with his life. He, you know, the label at the time was flying real high. He had all these bands that were just transitioning into major labels. They all did. I mean, he had Sonic Youth, and he had just signed Soundgarden. He had the Meat Puppets, and he had
Husker Du.
He had on and on, all of it. Firehose. Kind of. I mean, you could go down his whole roster. It all branched off into even Henry Rollins and everybody else. It just everything he had suddenly branched off into major labels within 1 or 2 years. I mean, he was the crux of that point. And I know most all of those people, and you know, he had all of their back catalogs. And as they all branched into the major labels, they you know, being the big corporations that they were, first thing they wanted to do was buy all the back catalog, you know, and start marketing their new product or whatever. And he wouldn't sell any of it. He didn't sell a single thing. He held it all. And well, you know, that kept him busy. He was busy enough. He didn't really have time to devote to, you know, maybe he didn't need to either. But anyway, so I had to move on.
And he didn't say anything like, "Can I have my $300 back?"
Oh, no. For him, you know.
Yeah.
I think he got his $300 worth.
First night.
But, you know, what can I say? I mean, you know, a lot of people have got bad stuff to say about him, honestly, especially lately with this whole business with the reunion and with Off and all that. And, you know, I can't say a bad word about him, you know, because of what he did for me.
So when you decided, okay, well, this is just sort of not working out, did you have a plan what to do next other than I'm going to do something different?
Not at all. I mean, I got a couple of jobs in record stores, and what I was finding out really quickly was that I didn't like it there. I didn't like the way it looked. I didn't like the way I had to live. I didn't like anything about it. I didn't like I didn't realize what I was getting into in terms of I'd never seen car culture before, you know, which is like, okay, here you have to spend like, you know, at least a third to a half of your day inside your car, you know. And that was kind of a shocker for me. I didn't like it. And, I mean, I liked my car, and I got to know it really well.
Did you spend the night there?
Oh, I started living in it from that point on.
You spent more than half your day in your car.
Yeah, yeah. I lived in it for quite a while. What I decided was I wanted to leave. I wanted to get out of there. I didn't know quite where I was going to go, but I just knew I needed to get out of there. I didn't like it. And so I got a couple of jobs, I think even three at one point, and I was just trying to save as much money as I could and not spend a dime and try and, you know, build up enough cash flow to just go wherever I wanted to go. And I was a bit, I wouldn't say lost, but I was a bit, you know, unsure of what to do next or where to go. But anyway.
So what happened?
I got a phone call from Iggy. That's what happened.
Of course.
we can back up to that story. I don't know. How long is this show?
Well, I got to ask you this. I mean, there are a million stories of people doing similar things, but they usually don't turn out like this.
Mm. They turn out good.
Well, I guess the obvious question is, you're living in your station wagon. How did Iggy get your phone number, or how did he find you, and how in the hell could you possibly land that gig?
Well, can I just tell a story? You're going to have to turn this into a weekly seminar or something.
Yeah, I think it's a college course. Where you just, like, you know, just go next door and
what not to do.
Professor Mullins has.
Let's see. Now, before that whole thing happened with leaving here and getting the phone call from Greg, just before that, I was in that funk of like, where do I go? What do I do? Our band had dissolved and, you know, the race had been run here. And I didn't know what to do. And, right around that time, Iggy Pop had, come out of a 4 or 5 year hiatus, and, I'd become a big fan of the Stooges and his records, that I'd been learning about the whole time I lived with Brian and Terry, and so I was pretty well educated and familiar with his whole repertoire and his whole story, and so I knew he was coming out of this hiatus, and he played a show on television that I saw, and he spent the whole time during that highly publicized televised show screaming and yelling at his drummer and throwing stuff at him. And I thought, man, what a mess, you know, and right up to the end, you know. And so it turns out we got his tour schedule, and he was playing in Memphis about 2 weeks later. And so a friend of mine here offered to drive me to Memphis, and we could go to see the show. So we went, and I was sitting there watching the show. He came out, and first thing I noticed was he had a different drummer, so I knew what had happened there. But it wasn't any better, and he spent that whole show doing the same things, throwing stuff and yelling at the guy and screaming at him, calling him every name in the book. And
did you agree with his opinion of the drummer?
Yeah. The guy wasn't good. He didn't he obviously, I mean, to be fair, he probably just got thrown into the gig. He just didn't know the stuff. He didn't have the right feel. He sure didn't understand what was really going on. It just wasn't right. And nothing was right, really. It was pretty bad. And I just remember sitting there thinking, man, this is not good. And, but, you know, Iggy was great. But I remember just thinking, God, you know, if only I was doing this, you know, I know exactly how this should go and how this should be and what, you know, what it should be feeling like. And, you know, I could fix this whole situation. But anyway, we were driving back to Knoxville. It's a 9-hour drive, you know. So halfway back is in Nashville, and he was playing in Nashville the next night. So we decided to go to that too. And so we saw that show, and it was the same thing, no better. And I remember thinking, yep, this is a mess. And I just got it in my craw that I have to fix it. Not only did I think I could fix it, I have to fix it. This is what, I just had the vision. This is what I have to do. I'm supposed to do this. I'm going to do it. So I got back here and started telling people that, and everyone thought I hit my head on a something. And I got the rest of his tour dates, and I saw he was, you know, he was opening up for the Pretenders at that time. So they had a cluster of shows in Ohio, where Chrissy Hynde was from. So I thought, well, Ohio, it's not that far away. I've got my car. I'm going to go after this. And so I put my drums in the back of that car, same car, and I drove up to Ohio. I bought tickets to all these shows, and I slept in my front seat, the first of many, many to come. But I slept in my car, and I went to all these shows. And so I prepared for this trip, so I'd made all these cassette tapes of me rehearsing down on Gay Street there, and so I wrote a whole bunch of handwritten letters kind of explaining where I was from, what Knoxville was like, and I told him all about the corner, and I told him that what I saw in his situation, what I knew about his life and the music, and how I thought I could, you know, make it all good, you know. And if you don't believe me, I got my drums in the car. I'll set them up in the parking lot. I was 18 years old. I totally believed in this. So I said, I got my drums out in the car. I'll set them up in the parking lot, and I'll show you.
Where do you think you got that moxie from?
I don't know. Survival? I grew up in South Knoxville, you know. It's like I'm just flying by the seat of my pants, you know. I the only thing I knew how to do was that, and I just thought, you know, it's been working for me so far, and you know, I believe that this is what was going to get me out of here.
If you just joined us, our guest on Flipside is Larry Mullins. He performed this most recent weekend at Big Ears with Silver Apples. We're talking about how he ended up playing with Iggy Pop and so many other great musicians. Tell me about these little mail packets that you mailed out.
I made these packages, you know, so I made, I don't know how many, a lot, all with these letters in there and with the same cassettes, and I figured I'm just going to keep handing these things to his roadies. Every show until, and sure, you know, keep throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and see if something sticks. So I every show I'd go and give these packages to the guys on stage. I'd give one to his bus driver outside, everybody, you know, anyone I could find that had anything to do with him. And it was going nowhere. Nothing was happening. And the end of that week, I was out of money and I was exhausted. And I thought, well, you know, I was out of tapes. In fact, you know, I thought, well, you know, I guess it's time to go back, you know. So I was going to go back that night, and anyway, every night he would do the same thing on stage. In one song, he would break the band down and sort of rattle off a whole bunch of daily philosophy, you know, whatever he happened to be getting into that day. But you know, he'd talk some interesting stuff there, but it was always different. Anyway, this night he almost verbatim started reading my letter. I knew it immediately as soon as he started going on. He was sometimes word for word, and you know, my jaw hit the floor. I thought, whoa, boy, we got a home run here. He definitely read that. And you know, he didn't say my name, but he was talking to me for sure. And so I thought, wow, you know, I did it, you know, it worked, Anyway, I got to go anyway. So, but I was walking out the door, and that's a pretty big hall, maybe three or 4,000 people in there. And his stage manager walked right up to me in that big crowd. Somehow this guy pinpointed me and found me. And he's a fairly large, healthy, muscular roadie from Leeds. And he came right up to me and more or less told me, I better get the hell out of Dodge or he's going to tear my head right off my shoulders. I said, hey, you know, don't worry, no hard feelings, you know. I'm just doing the only thing I knew how to do, you know. I'm leaving, you know. But anyway, it's funny because he's one of my best friends now. He's been my drum tech for 14 years. At the time, he was truly about ready to kill me. But anyway, I left. And that's what, that you know, I drove back. You know, my tail wasn't between my legs at all. I mean, I thought, you know, okay, I'm not going on the road with him today, but it worked. And I just thought, you know what, this is the way I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to get out of here writing letters. So sometimes I joke, it wasn't my drumsticks that got me out of here. It was a pencil. So I came back and I thought, all right, I'm going to make a plan here. I'm going to make a list of people that I feel strongly about, that I really want to play with, that I know a lot about, that I think I could fit in with, and I'm going to do the same. I'm just going to write them, but I'm going to mail the stuff instead, right? So I did it. I did the same thing. I mailed them out to here and there, and one of the guys I mailed to was Greg. And, you know, he called. You know, I was out there. You know, I'd pretty much forgotten this whole business about Iggy. But one night I was in a bar, and the David Letterman show was on the television in the bar. And I was just, oh, Iggy Pop's the guest tonight. And I thought, oh, well, that would be interesting. I'll watch that. So I was sitting there watching it, and David asked him, so I'm just curious, where do you find your musicians for your records? Because I notice, you know, you always have different people on every record. I mean, do you put an ad out in the newspaper, or what do you do? And they were joking, and Iggy's like, oh, no, there's always people coming, you know, that wanna play. And let me tell you a story. One time there was this drummer that was following me around, and he proceeded to tell him on the David Letterman show about me doing that.
I watched that show that same night.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, and I knew what was been going on. I was like, that's Larry.
You and I were in a parallel universe because I was watching it too, and I was going, that's me. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, he you know, that stuck with him. He remembers.
You're listening to Flipside. Our guest is former Knoxvillian Larry Mullins, though he's been in town playing at the Big Ears Festival with Silver Apples. And he's released so many of his own superb records. You just need to look up Toby Dammit and you'll find several. I've really been digging the one Luther and Toby, Carney Sutra, and also one with Thomas Weidler called Morphosa Harmonia. Anyway, we rejoin the story already in progress.
There was a fella in L.A. that had a guitar player who had been sort of showing up to a bunch of shows that this band I was playing in out there. At the time, he was, you know, asking me if I wanted to play with him or let's, you know, maybe just, you know, I wasn't really interested, but I was more interested in leaving. And anyway, he mentioned one night that he was going to audition for Iggy Pop the next day. And I said, what? He goes, yeah. He didn't even know who he was. He was just friends with his son. He was friends with Eric. And he said, yeah, my buddy is his son, and he set up this audition for me. Who is he? And I said, oh, my gosh. So I told him the story about Ohio and all this. I told him the whole thing. And I said, well, look, if you get a chance to talk to him, you should tell him that you know the fella who actually did that and that I'm living here. You know, he'll probably laugh it off, but it might break the ice and give you something funny to talk about, you know. Well, the next day I came home from work, and there was a message on my answering machine. You remember answering machines? Yep, I hit play, and there was a message on there, and it was from Iggy. And I listened to it, and he's sitting there telling me all this stuff, and I remember thinking, this is not real. This guy's pulling my leg. He's playing a joke on me. And, I went ahead and called the number and the hotel, and they put me with his room, and he answered the phone, and it was really him. So I thought, you know, I just listened to him. He said, look, you know, I want you to come down. I got this place where we can play tomorrow. I want you to come down, and I just want us to, you know, jam for a couple hours and just see how it goes. And I said, okay, I'll be there. So it was exactly how I thought it would be all along. We got along great. We played really naturally together. He was super happy. And then right afterwards, he just said, look, you know, I'm putting a band together. I've got like a 1-year schedule of shows, and I really want you to do it all with me, and that's the end of it. And I said, okay. And, you know, we never really talked about that whole business in Ohio. We just said, okay. And then we proceeded to be together every day for like 9 years after, you know, from that point. So I knew it was going to be like that.
Do you remember what tunes you played in the audition? And was there anything you didn't know? Or
no, there was, I knew everything, but it was a bunch of Stooges songs, really.
Yeah.
I knew exactly how the stuff was supposed to go. And but I also knew the solo stuff, too. And I explained to him. I mean, I knew he'd had some really great drummers, of course, Scott and then Hunt. And so he'd had this transition through some really key drummers that played really differently. But I tried to explain to him that I knew how to play like all of them, you know. And, you know, I'm like, you're missing your magic key, you know, because I can do all that. So, because a lot of guys could maybe just do that or that, you know, So we just locked in, and we you know, we were under, we did an 18-month tour together one time. I mean, we were very, very close for 9 years. And then we had he kind of shut down after a divorce, and I stopped working with him. We didn't really talk for 9 years. And then it kind of came back around again after I'd moved to Berlin, and I was working with an artist over there, an American girl, and his manager decided that he wanted to manage her. And so he started that, and then it was only a week or two into it. He said, well, what do you guys think about touring with the Stooges? And I said, well, it's going to be really good for her, but I don't want anything weird between us, you know, because, you know, we had our run, and, you know, it is like it is, and I'm fine. You know, I don't want to, you know, I'm not coming back on my knees here or nothing like that. So, no, he insisted. He really wanted us to tour with them. So we did. So we started opening up for the Stooges, and having a blast with those guys. You know, we got along so good. I mean, I knew Scott and Ron. I met them almost immediately after I started playing with Iggy, because one of the first shows was in Detroit, and those guys were there at the sound check. I was scared to death. You know, I was highly intimidated. But I met Scott in the bar next door. He put his arm around me like I was his nephew or something, and, you know, just sort of like said, you're okay, you know, and we totally got along great with him. So when we went on the road with the Stooges, it was Scott and Ron. So, you know, we were hanging out all the time in the bars with them and stuff like that, having a great time. And then, of course, Ron passed away, and it transitioned into James coming back in the band. And we did some shows with that lineup as well, but then Scott had a major health emergency on an airplane, and basically, you know, was in the hospital for 3 months. And so later that night, Iggy, you know, I got the first phone call from him in about 14 years, but, you know, it was a very brief phone call. He's like, you know, you have to get on a plane tomorrow and be here in London. We have like 2 days before the next show. He didn't ask. It was a direct command, or a matter of fact, you know. So I just, you know, had to cancel everything I was doing and go to the airport the next morning. And then, so for the last 5 years, we've been working again together, pretty closely, actually. And it's we kind of healed the gap that we had. So it's been a pretty good. So it's a funny thing with those guys, you know, because When the Stooges thing, it was a completely different experience with him, because it was much more family-oriented group. It was really like a family, kind of, all the guys, with Steve and James and even Mike and all these guys. And it got me, you know, meeting James Williamson, it got me thinking, because the first time I heard the Raw Power album was over here in Fort Sanders, and maybe we were even at the same party. But I think it was on 17th Street, one of these little houses, I don't know, I think I even drove by it yesterday, but there was a party in there, and there was a turntable in the living room, and record had run out, and someone yelled for me to go in the living room and put on another record or something. And I went in there, and I was flipping through the LPs and thinking, and I pulled up that Raw Power album. I'd never seen it before. And, of course, you know what the cover looks like, and I was kind of mesmerized by that image. I thought, what is that? What does that sound like? Ooh, look at that. So I put it on, and I remember just sitting in the living room there on my knees listening to, I think this is Search and Destroy, the first song.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, what is that? I was like, you know, and like that kind of writing, you know, James's weird writing, you know, is it's got this sort of, I call it kung fu, kind of kung fu writing. So it's you know, it's really jagged but I remember just listening to that thinking, God, you know, who are these people? Where are they from? What is this stuff? And getting really, really heavily into it. And now I think, you know, now James is kind of like my uncle, you know, like he and I are very close friends now. And all those guys are, you know, we've worked so hard together and had such a good time hanging out together. You know, they really kind of took me in as like part of the family in a way. And I remember just thinking how weird it was. I told James about that, you know, like I was sitting there listening to this record thinking, who are these people? And I could never know that, like, you know, what was it, 20 years down the line or 25 years down the line, everyone I'm listening to right now are going to be, that's going to be my family. You know, it's really, really weird how that worked, but it's really solid. Those guys are great. And we play really naturally together, but we get along. You know, we hang out all the time. We talk to each other on the phone and write each other all the time. You know, it's just, I can't explain why. But, you know, why, you know, they're all from Detroit. I'm from here. I don't know where I fit in, but somehow I did. But anyway, it's funny. We just made a solo record for James Williamson, which just came out. We made it a year ago, or even with the with this last Stooges record, the way we started, James was really pushing to do this stuff, and he really wanted to start writing again, and he couldn't really get Iggy to actively start from the beginning. So his theory was he just needed to make demos and start pushing it on Iggy and get him to write. And so he asked me if I'd do it with him, and of course I said yes. So it was just going to be me and James, really. So he booked some time in the studio. And he lives in the Bay Area, and I think we finished we'd finished a tour or something in San Francisco, so we were there. So I went and stayed at his house, and you know, his wife's doing my laundry. I mean, you know, it's totally casual, but really cool. And so the studio he books is Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, right?
You know, it's very famous. All of the great jazz records too, not to mention CCR and stuff.
On and on and on. And but you know, we pull up in the parking lot together. I pull up in the parking lot with James Williamson, and I'm looking at Fantasy Studios, the sign, just thinking like, am I dreaming? Like, this is not, how can this be real? It's like, you know, I'm going to, it's my fantasy here in Fantasy Studios. It's just me and James. It's like a crazy psychedelic dream, but it was real.
Our guest on this evening's Flipside, Larry Mullins, Knoxville native, who left Knoxville back in 1987 to eventually end up playing with Iggy Pop, The Residents, The Swans, so many other great folks. We'll put all of this online at WUOT.org, or you can email me for details at improv@utk.edu. Thanks for listening in. ¶¶